Okay, good afternoon, everyone. It's good to be back. I apologize if my glasses are not yet fully converted from being outside. But welcome nonetheless. It's good to be learning together. And I'm very excited to be sharing this topic. This is the kind of topic that spans the entirety of the Geula story from Parsha Shmos, for sure, through Parsha Bashalach. But you could even take us all the way into the Geula or the journey going on into the desert. And that's because there are two individuals that we kind of met last week in Parsha Shmos. We kind of see a little bit last week. We don't actually really see very much this week. For that, I apologize. Definitely see next week. But they don't seem to fit in. There are these two characters, two Anashim, that we see over and over again throughout the stories of the Jewish people in Egypt, leaving Egypt and traveling in the desert, and they're always up to no good. So if I were to ask you, I think anyone would ask you, who are the two individuals who are always causing troubles or always making mistakes? I guess Josh kind of gave it away in our title. But those two individuals are obviously Dustin and Aviram. Dustin and Aviram are the ones who are always making trouble in class. Dustin and Aviram are always the ones who are causing problems. And ironically, the only time we actually see them explicitly in the Psukim is not in Shmos, it's not in Va'era, Bo, B'Shalach. It's actually, we only ever see them explicitly in the Psukim come Parshas Korach, and because they are the partners of Korach in his uprising. But still, at least within the mindset of Chazal, even if it's not explicit in the Psukim, Dustin and Aviram, I think we can all agree, are bad guys. If I were to wake you up at 3 in the morning and say, who are the two nudniks, who are the dubious duo throughout the Exodus story, I think each and every one of us would respond, Dustin and Aviram. Dustin and Aviram are always up to no good. There's definitely this Torah about the connection between Nadav and Avihu, who are these lofty, holy individuals, who, in Bikravaya Kadesh, they're Aaron's sons, and they die in Parsha Shmini. So frequently, when I was growing up, we used to mistake Dustin and Aviram and Nadav and Avihu, and it still happened a lot. There's really Torah connecting the two of them, but that's not going to happen today. But Dustin and Aviram are the paradigmatic ne'er-do-wells. They're just always messing up. And so I have a simple question. And this bothered me, and Baruch Hashem looked into it, and I was able to find some sources through the help of Rabbi Jacobson, through the help of the Ask Baclaria database, and some other places. And we'll have a chance to see a few answers as to this question that's bothered me a lot. I suspect that it'll bother you as well. And the question really is motivated by our Parsha this week, because in Parsha's Bo, in the third Aliyah, we learn about the ninth plague of Choshech. And in Choshech, it is a tangible fog, a thick darkness where the Egyptians can't see anything, they can't even move. But Rashi tells us in Pasuk Kaf Beis in Perek Yud that the fog was not only, and the Choshech was not only for the Egyptians, that there was actually a purpose for the Jewish people to have this darkness for 3 days because he says that that there were wicked people in the era of the Geula who didn't want to leave. There were Jews who wanted to stay in Egypt, which is unfathomable, although we'll see an answer to that question. And during those 3 days, they died. So that they shouldn't die on the way out. It shouldn't be obvious to everyone in the whole world that all these Jews are not going to make it. And you know, there are other reasons for the darkness, but we see that during these 3 days, a number of Jews don't make it. A number of Jews who like being in Egypt, who prefer to be in Egypt, end up having to stay in Egypt. They die during the darkness. And what is that rate? What's the number? How many Jews decide that they want to stay? How many Jews are not interested in leaving Egypt? We don't see that answer right now. We don't see that answer in Parshas Bo. But at the beginning of Parshas Bashalach, Rashi tells us that the Chamushim, Alu B'nei Yisrael Me'aretz Yisrael, Chamushim might mean that, you know, the Jewish people left armed, but Rashi says Chamushim is language of Chamisha, language of one-fifth of the Jewish people leave Egypt, and the other four-fifths of the Jewish people opt to stay. Now, those four-fifths are not waving goodbye as the Jews leave. Those four-fifths died in Makas Koshech. And so we're not talking about, you know, like a few people, you know, like, you know, the, you know, that one minion on the side, the people who talk in the back, the people who the Gofer Kiddush Club, those people are the ones who stay behind. We're talking about a substantial number of Klal Yisrael. 80% of Klal Yisrael do not leave Egypt. And only the top tier, the upper echelon of the Jewish people only 20% end up leaving Egypt. We're made up of only that the top 20%. But there are two people within this top 20% of Am Yisrael who want to leave Egypt and who are righteous enough to leave Egypt. And yet, Dasan Avirim, how did Dasan Avirim get into this list? How did Dasan Avirim make the cut? If we're looking and saying, sorry, we're only taking the best of the best. I'm sorry, in order to get into our school, in order to get into our yeshiva, in order to come on this program, you need to be the best of the best of the best, and you're average. If someone is average, if someone is above average, you know, they say that 75% of drivers think that they're above average drivers, which is hilarious when you think about it for a moment. But within the Jewish people, even people who are pretty good, I think, you know, we teach in a school, and there are students who, if you get a 98, they will bug you and pester you until you give them a 100. And there are students who, if they get a 78 on a test, if they get a 75 on a test, if they know it's hard, they know it's challenging, they're in an AP class, and they're really pushing themselves, then 75, not so bad. 78, okay, I'll take it. And to think that only the top 80, the people above 80%, only the best of the Jewish people leave, okay, I can wrap my mind around that. But to think that Dasan Avirim, who were so terrible, that they're part of this, how is that possible? So after that long introduction, I try to understand how in the world did Dasan Avirim leave Egypt? We're going to try and see an answer. We're going to see a few more psukim in order to really get a picture of what made them so wicked, why this is bothering me so much, and why I think it should bother you. But those psukim as well will give us a perspective as to why they are in fact able to leave. And it starts really in the beginning that Dasan and Avirim are fighting one day. Moshe catches them, and they... it's the day after Moshe killed the Mitzri using this magical Shem Hashem, and they start yelling at Moshe, and Moshe says, "Oh, this is not a good situation." And they end up telling Parah on Moshe. That's, you know, in the beginning of Parsha Shmos, Perek Beis. And the Medrash commenting there tells us, Medrash Rava, that Dasan Avirim, this is the first time where we connect them. So Dasan Avirim, they're the ones who are fighting and telling Moshe. They're the ones who complain at Kriyas Yamsif, "Oh, we should go back to Egypt." They're the ones who try and mess with the Mon. They're the ones who are uprising around Korach. Over and over again, they're coming up. And the Alka Chimoni in Kuf Samach Zion says something very intense. It says, "Kol mash ata yoko litlos bereshaim tala." Anything that you can put on these specific Rishayim, on these individuals, anytime you see people doing the wrong thing amongst Klal Yisrael, assume that it was Dasan Avirim. That's pretty high. At the end of Parsha Shmos, we see Dasan Avirim encounter Moshe, and they're yelling at Moshe, because Moshe has now come to power and said, "I want the Jewish people to leave." And even though Parshas Bo started to ruin it, if you haven't gotten to it yet, the Jewish people are about to leave Egypt. But in the beginning of the end of Parsha Shmos, when the beginning of the story, things don't go just get better. They start out worse, and only then kind of trickle up. And Moshe says, "I want the Jewish people to leave." Parah says, "No, and as a matter of fact, not only are they not going to leave, but I'm going to make them work harder." And Dasan Avirim approach Moshe as he's at the end of the parsha and start yelling at him. Vayifka'u anoshim, they're yelling at Moshe and Aaron, saying, "You've made things so much worse." And Rashi there again comments that this is Dasan and Avirim. It's to such a extent that Dasa Kenemi Balei Tosfos in Bamidbar Tezayin, Pasuk Aleph, talks about Dasan and Avirim, that those names even are indicative of the fact that they are wicked people, that they are Rishon. Dasan Sha'avar al Das, that, you know, he's violating, you know, we call someone who's a really Zionist a Dati Lumi. Dat is law, that they violated the law, they violated the religion. Va'aviram She'ibet Atzma Mila Asos Tshuva. Aviram is a language that he has lost himself, that he has decided that he's not going to be able to do tshuva. So these names of Dasan Aviram, not only have they done bad things, but even their names are telling us at how wicked they are, how terrible they are. And just something interesting we see from the Maharal, he looks at a pasuk that where they refer to as Anoshim, and he says, "How is it possible that we refer to Dasan Avirim, who are not good guys, who are not tzaddikim, who are not coveted on individuals, as an ish? Ish is always a language of honor, of respect." And he says, "It's possible to have an ish that's a Russia, someone who is so archetypically evil that he's going to be called an ish as well. He's not an ish as in a righteous sense. He's an ish as in a wicked sense." And so trying to understand all of this, how does Dasan Avirim leave when they're clearly so wicked? They're clearly challenging Moshe on such a consistent basis. They're yelling at him, and accusing him of being the reason why the Jewish people are getting more work. They're so frequently yelling Moshe, how are they able to leave? And maybe we'll add on a couple other things that might give us a bigger picture. In the Rashi, we quote in the beginning that the 3 days of darkness meant that the people who wanted to stay in Egypt ended up staying in Egypt permanently, that they died in Egypt. Then we're left to wonder, is it just Dathan and Aviram who are always causing problems? Are Dathan and Aviram the only ones who are bringing up this, oh, we should go back to Egypt, so frequently? It's like it's a refrain. You know, they're just playing, it's just a record over and over again. Every time something bad happens, particularly in the next few weeks, for sure in Parshas Beshalach, anytime something bad happens, what do we hear? Oh, this is terrible, let's go back to Egypt. Oh, this is terrible, let's go back to Egypt. Over and over again, people are saying, let's go back to Egypt. If you didn't want to leave Egypt, then you shouldn't be here. Anyone who didn't really want to leave Egypt, anyone who wanted to stay, would have died in Choshech. So is it just us and Aviram who are the ones who are repeating this refrain over and over again of let's go back to Egypt? And finally, there's something fascinating that we're going to see at the beginning of next week's Parsha. Because in the beginning of next week's Parsha, we encounter psukim that are very unusual. Paro is told that the Jewish people have left. And Paro says in the psukim, Va'amar Paro, Lib b'nei Yisrael. Nebukam hi ba'aretz sagar lehem amidbar. The Jewish people are lost. But he says, Lib b'nei Yisrael. Now, if I were to ask you, almost as instinctively as if you were to tell me the two wicked one individuals throughout the Torah are Dathan and Aviram, if I were to ask you, what does the prefix Lamed teach you? What does the prefix Lamed mean? Even the students who aren't so good at reading tend to know this one. This one is right there for all of us to take. This one's easy enough. The prefix Lamed means two. And so if I were to say Le'echol, it goes from being Achila to eating to eat. And Lidaber is to speak. And Lit B'nai Yisrael, if I'm speaking Lit B'nai Yisrael, it means that I'm speaking to B'nai Yisrael. And so when Paro says Lit B'nai Yisrael in Parshas Beshalach, Rashi and really all of the Mefarshim try and figure out, who's he talking to? There's no way that Paro in Beshalach sitting in Egypt could be talking to the Jewish people because the Jewish people left. The Jewish people aren't there. He's talking about B'nai Yisrael. And so Rashi ends up telling us that Libnei Yisrael really means al Bnei Yisrael. It means that he's talking about Bnei Yisrael because he obviously could not be talking to the Jewish people. They have departed from Egypt in Parshas Bo. However, that's what the vast majority of Mefarshim say. But the Targum Yonatan says something fascinating. He says, V'yemar Paro spoke le Dathan v'Aviram, Bnei Yisrael. He spoke to not all of Bnei Yisrael, but he spoke to two members of Bnei Yisrael. Who are those two members of Bnei Yisrael? Dathan and Aviram. Dathan and Aviram, who seem to love it in Egypt and don't want to leave. Dathan and Aviram, who are totally wicked, who literally stay back in Egypt. Paro is talking to just them. What that means is that Dathan and Aviram, who show up in the Korach story, who we know are in the Korach story, the Psukim say that, Targum Yonatan is telling us that they're still in Egypt after the Jewish people leave, and Paro is talking to them. How did they end up getting with everybody else? And so I haven't seen the Vilna Gaon inside, but I'm told by Rabbi Mordechai Berg, and the Sefer Beremayim Chaim alludes to this. Dathan and Aviram basically run after the Jewish people, and they miss the Kriyas Yamsuf. And I don't know if anyone's ever been done the sprint through the airport. You know, you're holding your bags, you're running, and you're thinking, why didn't I just put my tefillin in my backpack? I didn't have to hold it onto it separately. Now I've got an extra thing to hold onto. And you're running. My wife and I have cut it close, not that many times, but there was one time I remember not even rushing because I thought I had so much time, but for whatever reason, the cabin doors closed earlier than they usually do, and I arrived. I remember banging on the door saying, no, I can't believe we missed a flight, and I was under the impression that you're not allowed to reopen that door. They always say once you close the door, then legally we're not allowed to reopen it, but the very, very nice flight attendant saw that I was there, thought I was distressed, and very kindly opened it for us. So I can imagine the angst with which Dathan and Aviram feel. They're running after Bnei Yisrael, and they miss Kriyas Yamsuf. And they're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. Kriyas Yamsuf's over. Legally, they're not allowed to pass through anymore. What are we going to do? We're stuck in Egypt now. And says the Vilna Gaon, there's a second Kriyas Yamsuf for just Dathan and Aviram. Just Dathan and Aviram get their own Kriyas Yamsuf. So we're talking about people who, we know are Rishon. The Yaakov Shimoni says they're Rishon. Talking about people who fight against Moshe Rabbeinu. Talking about people who decide to stay in Egypt. They should have died during Marcus Koshik, and yet they don't. How are they saved? So we're going to see two and a half answers. It's two and a half because The Maharal and the other answer we'll bring are basically the same, but they phrase it a little differently. The Maharal in his Gevurah Hashem tells us, what makes Dasan Aviram special? Dasan Aviram were Rishayim. They were not good guys. But understand, what does it mean that they weren't Rishayim? Why weren't they Rishayim? It's not their fault. Moshe and Aaron are born. Moshe and Aaron are part of Bnei Israel, and they are so holy. They're overwhelmingly holy. It point out the when Moshe is born, the house fills with light. Moshe and Aaron almost instinctually going to do the right thing. And to have such positivity in the world, there always has to be a counterbalance. There always has to be a negative force. Who's the negative force of Moshe and Aaron? Who is the antithesis of Moshe and Aaron? I would have told you, I would have thought, it's Paro. There is a beautiful symbolism of Paro, who's the king. And if you think about how kings work, unless you're in the Windsor family over the past century or so, think about how kings work. It's always the oldest brother, a son, whose oldest son becomes king, whose oldest son becomes king, whose oldest son becomes king. So when you have Paro standing on the throne of Egypt, this is the eldest of many generations standing there representing the oldest son. And then you have Moshe Rabbeinu at odds with him. Moshe Rabbeinu, who is... It's not only there was a girl born for him, but he's not even the firstborn son of Amram, who's not the firstborn son, of Levi, who's not the firstborn son, of Yaakov, who's not the firstborn son. We have a younger brother, a generational younger brother, for years and years and years, all the way back at least to Avram Avinu. You can go even further back to Shem. All of these individuals are represented in Moshe Rabbeinu, who's the younger brother, against Paro, who is the older brother. That's totally unrelated to our shir, but fascinating nonetheless. But I would have assumed that Paro is that antithesis to Moshe. Says the Maharal, no, the antithesis to Moshe and Aaron are Dasan and Aviram. Dasan and Aviram, who are unusual. Dasan and Aviram, who are always fighting back. They're always pushing against Moshe. These two individuals are overwhelmingly wicked. It's not their fault, though. They need to be that counterbalance to Moshe. If Moshe and Aaron are going to be leading Bnei Israel, then Dasan and Aviram need to be there to fight against, to push back, to give some level of choice, if you will. So that's the Maharal. We can take it a little bit further with the Be'er Maim. Now, the Be'er Maim is not a sefer. You should be scratching your head saying, I know that one. I don't envision you would know it. If you look on your shelf, you're probably not going to find it. I don't know that it's the case, but I might have the only copy in Chicago. I got this sefer when I was doing Torah Tours, which is a program, a wonderful program that Yeshiva University runs for really like kids, pishers. For kids who are in college who want to be mashpia, who want to share Torah over the course of Shavuos. They'll send them to far-flung communities. I believe in Chicago we've gotten a few of these Torah Tours individuals. They'll go to San Diego. They'll go to Florida. Once in a while they'll even go all the way to England. And so I sign up, and I'm hearing stories about how people get flown all over the country to make these amazing Shavuos, amazing Shavuoses. They give shurim and all these things. And I find out my group's going to Philly. So Philly's actually not bad. I'm not so disappointed. I'm not getting flown out. I'm going to drive instead. But nonetheless, I go and spend Yom Tov there. I give a couple of shirim. I'm sure that they were abysmal and awful. But the very, very sweet people of Elkins Park, Philadelphia, didn't tell me as much. They said it was great. Thank you so much for coming. And encouraged me to continue teaching Torah till this day. But what was an unknown highlight was at the end of Shabbat, of Yom Tov, the Rav calls me into his office. And I'm convinced that I said something wrong. If anyone who knows me well, I knows that it's not totally unheard of for me to say something a little that might get me in trouble. And so I'm convinced I'm going to get in trouble. And the Rav calls me, Rabbi Brisman, and says, thank you so much for coming. I want to give you my grandfather's sefer. And he gives me a sefer on Medrash Rabbah. I don't have a lot of Sfarim commenting on Medrash Rabbah. If people have a Medrash Rabbah, that's usually enough for them. But this is a sefer on Medrash Rabbah, and it is Matok Mitvash. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. And in there, Rabbi Brisman, super senior, Rabbi Brisman's grandfather, tells us that it's the same Yisodas of Maharal, although he doesn't quote him, that Dasan Aviram are that counterbalance to Moshe Rabbeinu. But he gives it a little bit more. He gives a little more detail. He says Moshe Rabbeinu was this otherworld individual. Moshe Rabbeinu is making miracles all the time. And for Dasan Aviram, that wasn't going to work. Dasan Aviram are the Derech HaTeva types. They're the natural world. They need it to be rational. They need it to be logical. They have to explain it. And so anytime Moshe does something supernatural, they have to counterbalance with something by trying to be extremely natural. When Moshe Rabbeinu kills an Egyptian, and this explains their first interaction, Moshe Rabbeinu kills an Egyptian using the Shema Mefurash, using God's name. He basically says a magic spell, and the Egyptian drops dead. and Dustin and Viram start fighting against him. They start clashing because they are natural people. When Moshe Rabbeinu was going to split the sea, they're fighting against it, saying, let's elect a new leader and let's go home because this is going to be a miracle and we don't do miracles. Moshe Rabbeinu is going to bring money. Moshe Rabbeinu is going to bring food. And they fight against it and say, we need things to be natural. Anytime there's a concern that things might be beyond nature, Dustin and Aviram are at odds with Moshe Rabbeinu. And so that's 1.5 answers as to why Dustin and Aviram get to stick around, because they're that necessary counterbalance. Any good leadership and any good organization knows that you can't just have one person at the top and no one ever kind of pushing back, fighting against, suggesting an alternative option. In the world of organizational psychology now, that is of the utmost importance. And Dustin and Aviram were that personality for Moshe. It sounds like the Jewish people kind of caught along, and a lot of them used to push against Moshe. But at the very least, Dustin and Aviram were the experts. That's answers number 1.5. But the second answer is going to knock your socks off. So most of us are sitting, we are in Zoom, but a couple of you who are standing, I strongly encourage you to sit down. You will not believe this. But in order to start, we need to look at a medrash in the Akos Shimoni that's really talking about Parshas Baaloska. Because Baaloska, Moshe Rabbeinu says, this nevuah is too much for me, I need help. And God says, great. Pick 70 elders. Asva leaves a kainim ish, a shivim ish. I got to find 70 people. And at this point in time, Moshe's like, do I pick the zakenim? I'm not sure. And God says, don't pick the zakenim per se. The 70 men are already chosen for you. They're going to be the shotrim. The shotrim, the taskmasters, if you will, from the taskmasters from when you were in Egypt, they're going to be my Nevi'im, they're going to be the ones who are going to get the Nevuah for Am Yisrael because they have a very special skill. What's that special skill? You're likely familiar that when the Egyptians set unrealistic goals for the Jews during their servitude, they didn't punish each and every individual Jew. That was just Yifshar, what's going to happen? So what they do, they had a Jewish taskmaster, and that Jewish taskmaster used to be the one who would take a beating anytime the Jews weren't working hard enough. And because he didn't want to get beaten, he would force his Jewish brothers and sisters to work even harder. But these holy, incredible shotrim, these leaders of Bnei Israel, said, I can't do that to my brothers and sisters. I can't do that to the Jewish people. So I'm going to take the hit. I'll let the Egyptians beat me because we didn't fill our quota rather than me hurt another Jew. And those that came end up becoming Nevi'im. They end up becoming, you know, the second in command, if you will, to Moshe Rabbeinu, albeit for that short period. And says the Maharal Diskin, the Brisker Rav, something fascinating. What was the skus that Dustin Aviram had? What made Dustin Aviram so special? They were amongst the shotrim. They were tremendous tzaddikim. They took a hit. They took a beating on behalf of Klal Yisrael. They tried to remove the pain of Klal Yisrael. And so even though Dustin Aviram, this is not in contrast to our first answer. It might even be a building on the first answer. It's not that Dustin and Aviram were good guys. They were not good guys, but they had a tremendous skus. In this one instance, they shined. For however long the Egyptian taskmasters were beating the Jews extra, the Dustin and Aviram took on extra. Dustin and Aviram said, I'm not going to let another Jew be in pain. And he continues, and if you pay attention to all the different circumstances, this is Dustin and Aviram, Lishitasa. Dustin and Aviram are fighting Moshe, not because they're just wicked people, but they're fighting Moshe because they don't want Bnei Israel to be in more pain. When Moshe Rabbeinu is the result of them having more work to do, they go and start yelling at Moshe Rabbeinu. What's the lashon they use? What do they say to him? Effectively say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu should judge you. HaKadosh Baruch Hu should make a din on you because you have made the Jewish people suffer more. And to Dustin and Aviram, albeit somewhat flawed, somewhat skewed, as far as they were concerned, the most important thing you could possibly do in this world is to try and relieve the suffering of another Jew, try and worry about another Jew. There was nothing that they cared about more, even if it meant fighting against Moshe Rabbeinu. And so why do they zoko to get saved? Well, as far as they're concerned, and actually as far as Avraham Shor is concerned, his lack of Yalibub, the secret to Geula is gufa this. Ein lecha zokos gadol mizu. The secret to being redeemed is not worrying about myself, but worrying about someone else. We see this in modern psychology, that when someone needs a redemption, when someone needs to be saved in some way, shape, or form, someone's suffering, worrying about yourself is never going to do the trick. Worrying about yourself is never going to get you out of your rut. But if you worry about someone else, if you give someone a pet, you give someone else to care for, and they can care for someone else, they can give to someone else, That's what creates their geula. So just like in the world today, we might not be in physical servitude. That's the conversation always in and around Pesach time. The servitude that we're in is maybe more of an emotional or a spiritual or an intellectual servitude. Back in the day, the way to get out of that geula was to worry about someone else. And in the world today, the way to get out of your gullus, to get out of your servitude, is to worry about someone else. I'll just add one other thing from Ari Khan, which I think is fascinating. If Dustin and Aviram were the shochrim, they were the leaders, then the group of people that they gather in the time of Korach actually make a lot of sense. Because as much as Dustin and Aviram ended up being good guys, they might not have always been good guys. Because we, unfortunately, in our history, are aware of individuals who were not such good guys and who were leaders of small groups of Jews, of taskmasters, if you will. We call them kapos during the Shoah. And the kapos, some of them were worrying about the Jewish people, but many of them, unfortunately, were selfish, and they benefited from the Jews' suffering. And suggests Rabbi Ari Khan, I think it's not Rabbi Ari Khan, I think he's quoting from the Kli Yakar, or somebody similar. Rabbi Ari Khan certainly is the one who shared it with me, that who are the people who ever want to go back to Egypt? Why are there ever people who want to go back to Egypt? It's not that they didn't want to go, but when they think back about Egypt, we always wonder, like, how did these Jews who suffered so much as slaves ever think to go back? The ones who want to go back are not slaves. The ones who want to go back were the kapos. They were the ones who were benefiting from being in Egypt. They were living a good life. They were eating good food. They genuinely were eating good food because they were rising above the slaves of their brethren. They're rising on top. They're stepping on their slaves, brothers and sisters. And so Dustin and Aviram overcome the good life. They say, even though my life could be good, life could be easy, I could be a kapo, I'm going to turn toward Klal Yisrael. I'm going to have Klal Yisrael's best interests in mind. And so as we read this psukim, and as we go through these parashios, and we think about Geula, it's not always so easy to connect with the idea of leaving another country and being saved like as a refugee. Maybe for our Ukrainian brothers and sisters, they can appreciate that. But for us, if there's anything we're struggling with, anything we're going through, that lesson from Dustin Aviram, that lesson from Avraham Shor, that the key to Geula is to worry about somebody else. It's been a pleasure learning together. I'm happy to field any questions. If not, have a wonderful day.